You were clumsy or vulnerable. I took my bearings with a quick look around. The woods were the same, all three times I'd been through them. A hillside sank down ahead of me and climbed steadily into the night behind me. At the top of the mountain I stood upon, I was told, was a narrow and bitterly cold pass that led into the interior of the Unseelie Mountains, to Mab's stronghold of Arctis Tor. Below me, the land sank into foothills and then into plains, where Mab's authority ended, and that of Titania, the Summer Queen, began. I stood at a crossroads, which was only sensible since I'd arrived from Chicago, one of the great crossroads of the world. One trail led upslope and down, the other crossed it at almost perfectly right angles and ran along the face of the hillside. I took a left following the face of the hillside in a counterclockwise direction, also known as Widdershins in the parlance of the locals. The trail ran between frozen trees, their branches bowed beneath their burden of frost and snow. I moved quickly, but not quickly enough to slip and blow out an ankle or brain myself on a low-hanging branch. The White Council had Mab's permission to move through the woods, but they were by no means safe. I found that out for myself about 15 minutes into my walk, when snow suddenly fell softly from the trees all around, and silent black shapes descended to encircle me. It happened quickly and in perfect silence. Maybe a dozen spiders the size of ponies alit upon the frozen ground or clung to the trunks and branches of the surrounding trees. They were smooth-surfaced, sharp-edged creatures, like orb weavers, long-limbed and graceful and deadly-looking. They moved with an almost delicate precision, their bodies of a color of gray and blue and white that blended flawlessly with the snowy night. The spider who had come down onto the trail directly in front of me raised its two forelegs in warning and revealed fangs longer than my forearm, dripping with milky white venom. "Halt, man-thing," said the creature. That was actually scarier than the mere appearance of economy-sized arachnids. Between its fangs, I could see a mouth moving, a mouth that looked disturbingly human. Its multiple eyes gleamed like beads of obsidian. Its voice was a chirping, buzzing thing. "Halt, he whose blood will warm us! Halt, intruder upon the wood of the Winter Queen!" I stopped and looked around the circle of spiders. None of them seemed to be particularly larger or smaller than the others. If I had to fight my way clear, there wasn't any obvious weak link to exploit. "Greetings," I said as I did. "I am no intruder, honored hunters. I am a wizard of the White Council, and I and my folk have the Queen's permission to tread these paths." The air around me shivered with chitters and hisses and clicks.
"Man-things speak often with false tongues,"
said the lead spider, its forelimbs thrashing the air in agitation. I held up my staff. "I guess they always have one of these, too, huh?" The spider hissed, and venom bubbled from the tips of its fangs.
"Many a man-thing bears such a long stick, mortal."
"Careful, legs," I said. "I'm on speaking terms with Queen Mab herself. I don't think you want to play it like this." The spider's legs shifted in an undulating motion, and the spider rippled 2 or 3 feet closer to me. The other spiders all shifted too, moving a bit nearer. I didn't like that, not even a little. If one of them jumped, they'd be all over me, and there were just too many of the damn big things to defend myself against them effectively. The spider laughed, the sound hollow and mocking.
"Mortals, do not speak to the queen and live to tell the tale."
"It lies,"
hissed the other spiders, the phrase a low buzzing around me,
"and its blood is warm."
I eyed all those enormous fangs and had an acutely uncomfortable flashback to Morgan driving his straw through the top of that damn juice box. A spider in front of me flowed a little to the left and a little to the right, the graceful motion intended to distract me from the fact that it had gotten about a foot closer to me.
"Man-thing, how are we to know what you truly are?"
"In my professional opinion, you rarely get handed a straight line that good." I thrust the tip of my staff forward, along with my gathered will, focusing it into an area the size of my own clenched fist as I shouted,
Forzare!
An invisible force hammered into the lead spider, right in its disturbing mouth. It lifted the huge beast off all 8 of its feet, drove it 15 feet backward through the air, and ended at the trunk of an enormous old oak. The spider smacked into it like an enormous water bottle, making a hideous splattering sound upon impact. It bounced off the tree and landed on the frozen ground, its legs all quivering and jerking spasmodically. Maybe 300 pounds of snow, shaken loose by the impact, came plummeting down from the oak tree's branches and half buried the body. Everything went still and silent. I narrowed my eyes and swept my gaze around the circle of monstrous arachnids. I said nothing. The spider nearest its dead companion shifted its weight warily from leg to leg. Then, in a much quieter voice, it trilled,
"Let the wizard pass."
"Damn right let him pass," I muttered under my breath. Then I strode forward as though I intended to smash anything else that got in my way. The spiders scattered. I kept walking without slowing, breaking stride, or looking back. They didn't know how fast my heart was beating or how my legs were trembling with fear, and as long as they didn't, I would be just fine. After 100 yards or so, I did look back, only to see the spiders gathered over the body of their dead companion. They were wrapping it up in silk, their fangs twitching and jerking hungrily. I shuddered and my stomach twisted onto itself. One thing you can count on when visiting the Never Never, you don't ever get bored. I turned off the forest path onto a foot trail at a tree whose trunk had been carved with a pentacle. The trees turned into evergreens and crowded close to the trail. Things moved out of sight among the trees, making small scuttling noises, and I could barely hear high-pitched whispers and sibilant voices coming from the forest around me. Creepy, but par for the course. The path led up to a clearing in the woods. Centered in the clearing was a mound of earth about 12 yards across and almost as high, thick with stones and vines. Massive slabs of rock formed the posts and lintel of a black doorway. A lone figure in a gray cloak stood beside the doorway, a lean and fit-looking young man with cheekbones sharp enough to slice bread and eyes of cobalt blue. Beneath the gray cloak, he wore an expensive dark blue cashmere suit with a cream-colored shirt and a metallic copper-colored tie. A black bowler topped off the ensemble, and instead of a staff or a blasting rod, he bore a silver-headed walking cane in his right hand. He was also holding the cane at full extension, pointed directly at me with narrowed, serious eyes as I came down the trail. I stopped and waved a hand. "Easy there, Steed." The young man lowered the cane, and his face blossomed into a smile that made him look maybe 10 years younger. "Ah," he said, "not too obvious a look, one hopes." "It's a classic," I said. "How you doing, Chandler?"
"I am freezing off my well-tailored ass," Chandler said cheerily, in an elegant accent straight from Oxford. "But I endure, thanks to excellent breeding, a background in preparatory academics, and metric tons of British fortitude." Those intense blue eyes took a second look at me, and though his expression never changed, his voice gained a touch of concern. "How are you, Harry?"
"Been a long night," I said, walking forward. "Aren't there supposed to be 5 of you watching the door?"
"5 of me guarding the door? Are you mad?
The sheer power of the concentrated fashion sense would obliterate visitors on sight." I burst out in a short laugh.
"You must use your powers only for good."
"Precisely, and I shall." He tilted his head thoughtfully. "I can't remember the last time I saw you here."
"I only visited once," I said, "and that was a few years ago, right after they drafted me." Chandler nodded soberly.
"What brings you out of Chicago?"
"I heard about Morgan."
The young warden's expression darkened.
"Yes," he said quietly. "It's hard to believe."
"You're here to help find him?"
"I've found murderers before," I said. "I figure I can do it again." I paused.
For whatever reason, Chandler was almost always to be found working near the senior counsel. If anyone would know the scuttlebutt, he would.
"Who do you think I should talk to about it?"
"Wizard Liberty is coordinating the search," he replied. Wizard listens to wind, is investigating the scene of the murder. Ancient Mai is getting the word out to the rest of the council to convene an emergency session. I nodded. What about Wizard McCoy? Standing by with the strike team, when last I heard, Chandler replied. He's one of the few who can reasonably expect to overpower Morgan. Yeah, I said. Morgan's a pain in the ass, all right. I shivered and stamped my feet against the cold. I've got some information they're going to want. Where do I find them? Chandler considered. Ancient Mai should be in the Crystalline Hall. Wizard Liberty is in the offices. Wizard McCoy should be somewhere near the war room, and Wizard Listens to Wind and the Merlin are in LaFortier's chambers. How about the gatekeeper? I asked. Chandler shrugged. Gatekeeping, I dare say. The only wizard I see less frequently than he is you. I nodded. Thanks, Chandler. I faced him soberly and put a formal solemnity in my voice as I adhered to security protocols more than 5 centuries old. I seek entry to the hidden halls, O Warden. May I pass? He eyed me for a moment and gave me a slow, regal nod, his eyes twinkling. Be welcome to the seat of the White Council. Enter in peace and depart in peace. I nodded to him and walked forward through the archway. I'd come in peace, sure, but if the killer was around and caught on to what I was doing, I wouldn't depart in peace. Just pieces. Chapter 14. The hidden halls of Edinburgh were the redoubt and fortress of the White Council of Wizardry from time immemorial. Well, actually, that last bit isn't true. It's been our headquarters for a little under 500 years. The White Council has existed since pre-Roman times, in one form or another, and its headquarters has shifted from time to time and place to place. Alexandria, Carthage, Rome. We were in the Vatican in the early days of the church, believe it or not. Constantinople and Madrid have all been home to the Council's leadership at one time or another, but since the end of the Middle Ages, they've been located in the tunnels and catacombs hewn from the unyielding stone of Scotland. Edinburgh's tunnel network is even more extensive than those beneath the city of Chicago, and infinitely more stable and sturdy. The main headquarters of the complex is located deep beneath the old rock itself, Castle Edinburgh, where kings and queens, lords and ladies, have defied, besieged, betrayed, and slaughtered one another since pre-Christian times. There's a reason a fortress has been there for as long as mankind can remember. It's one of the world's largest convergences of ley lines. Ley lines are the natural currents of magical energy running through the world. They are the most powerful means of employing magic known to man. And the lines that intersect in the earth deep below the old rock represent a staggering amount of raw power waiting to be tapped by someone skilled or foolish enough. I walked over a ley line about 3 steps after I entered the hidden halls, and I could feel its shuddering energy beneath my feet, rushing by like an enormous, silent subterranean river. I walked a bit faster for a few paces, irrationally nervous about being swept off my feet by it, until I could only sense it as a dim and receding vibration in the ground. I didn't need to call up a light. Crystals set in the wall glowed in a rainbow of gentle colors, bathing the whole place in soft ambient illumination. The tunnel was ancient, worn, chilly, and damp. Water always seemed ready to condense into a half-frozen dew the instant it was given the opportunity by an exhaled breath or a warm body. The tunnel was about as wide as my spread arms and maybe 8 feet high. The walls were lined with bas-relief carvings in the stone. Some of them were renditions of scenes of what I've been told were the historical high points of the White Council. Since I didn't recognize anyone in the images, I didn't have much context for them, so they mostly just looked like the crudely drawn cast of thousands you see in the Bayeux tapestry. The rest of the carvings were wards. Seriously world-class heavyweight wards. I didn't know what they did, but I could sense the deadly power behind them, and I trod carefully as I passed deeper into the complex. The entry tunnel from the Never Never was more than 1/4 of a mile long, sloping gently downward the whole way. There were metal gates every couple of hundred yards, each of them manned by a warden, backed up by a pair of ancient Mai's temple dog statues. The things were 3 feet high at the shoulder and looked like escapees from a Godzilla movie. Carved from stone, the blocky figures sat inert and immobile, but I knew that they could come to dangerous life at an instant's notice. I tried to think about what it might be like to be facing a pair of aggressive temple dog statues in the relatively narrow hallway. I decided that I'd rather wrestle an oncoming subway locomotive. At least then it would be over quickly. I exchanged polite greetings with the wardens on guard until I passed the last checkpoint and entered the headquarters proper. Then I took a folded map from my duster pocket, squinted at it, and got my bearings. The layout of the tunnels was complex, and it would be easy to get lost. Where to begin? If the gatekeeper had been around, I would have sought him out first. Rashid had been my supporter and ally on more than one occasion. God knew why. I wasn't on what anyone would call good terms with the Merlin. I barely knew Martha Liberty, or Listens to Wind. I found Ancient Mai to be a very scary little person. That left Ebenezer. I headed for the war room. It took me the better part of half an hour to get there. Like I said, the tunnel complex is enormous, and after the way the war had reduced the ranks of the council, it seemed lonelier and emptier than ever. My footsteps echoed hollowly back from stone walls for minutes at a time, unaccompanied by any other sound. I felt intensely uncomfortable as I paced the hidden halls. I think it was the smell that did it. When I'd been a young man, hauled before the council to be tried as a violator of the first law of magic, they had brought me to Edinburgh. The musty, wet, mineral smell of the place had been almost all I knew while I had waited, hooded and bound, in a cell for a full day. I remember being horribly cold and tortured by the knots my muscles worked themselves into after so many hours tied hand and foot. I remember feeling more alone than ever in my life. While I awaited whatever was going to happen, I had been scared. So scared. I was 16. It was the same smell, and that scent had the power to animate the corpses of some of my darkest memories and bring them lurching back into the front of my thoughts. Psychological necromancy. Brains, I moaned to myself, drawing the word out. If you can't stop the bad thoughts from coming to visit, at least you can make fun of them while they're hanging around. In a stroke of improbable logic, the war room was located between the central chambers of the senior council and the barracks rooms of the wardens, which included a small kitchen. The smell of baking bread cut through the musty dampness of the tunnel, and I felt my steps quickening. I passed the barracks, which would doubtless be empty for the most part. Most of the wardens would be out hunting Morgan, as evidenced by the skeleton guard I'd seen at Chandler's post. I took the next left, nodded to the very young warden on guard, opened a door, and passed into the war room of the White Council. It was a spacious vault, about 100 feet square, but the heavy arches and pillars that supported the ceiling took away a lot of that room. Illuminating crystals glowed more brightly here to make reading easier. Bulletin boards on rolling frames took up spaces between pillars and were covered by maps and pins and tiny notes. Most of them had one or more chalkboards next to them, which were covered in diagrams, cryptic, brief notation, and cruder maps. Completely ordinary office furniture occupied the back half of the vault, broken up into cubicles. Typewriters clacked and dinged. Men and women of the administrative staff, wizards all, moved back and forth through the room, speaking quietly, writing, typing, and filing. A row of counters on the front wall of the room supported coffee pots warmed by propane flames, and several well-worn couches and chairs rested nearby. Half a dozen veteran wardens lay sprawled on couches napping, sat in chairs reading books, or played chess with an old set upon a coffee table. Their staves and cloaks were all at hand, ready to be taken up at an instant's notice. They were dangerous, hard men and women, the old guard, survivors of the deadly days of the early vampire war. I wouldn't have wanted to cross any of them. Sitting in a chair slightly apart from them, staring at the flames crackling in a rough stone fireplace, sat my old mentor, Ebenezer McCoy. He held a cup of coffee in his thick, work-scarred fingers. A lot of the more senior wizards in the council had a sense of propriety they took way too seriously, always dressed to the nines, always immaculate and proper. Ebenezer wore an old pair of denim overalls with a flannel shirt and leather work boots that could have been 30 or 40 years old. His silver hair, what he had left of it, was in disarray, as if he'd just woken from a restless sleep. He was aging, even by wizard standards, but his shoulders were still wide, and the muscles in his forearms were taut and visible beneath age-spotted skin. He stared at the fire through wire-rimmed spectacles, his dark eyes unfocused, one foot slowly tapping the floor. I leaned my staff against a handy wall, got myself a cup of coffee, and settled down in a chair beside Ebenezer's. I sipped coffee, let the warmth of the fire drive some of the wet chill out of my bones, and waited.
"They always have good coffee here," Ebenezer said a few moments later.
"And they don't call it funny names," I said. "It's just coffee, not Frappalappa Grandicino." Ebenezer snorted and sipped from his cup. "Nice trip in. Got tripped up by someone's thugs on the winter trail." He grimaced.
"Aye. We've had our people harassed several times the past few months. How are you, Hoss?"
"Uninformed, sir," I said. He eyed me obliquely.
"I did as I thought best, boy. I won't apologize for it."
"Don't expect you to," I said. He nodded.
"What are you doing here? What do you think?"
He shook his head.
"I won't take you on the strike team, Hoss."
"You think I can't pull my weight?" He turned his eyes to me.
"You have too much history with Morgan. This has got to be dispassionate, and you're just about the least dispassionate person I know."
I grunted. "You sure it was Morgan who did LaFortier?" His eyes returned to the fire.
"I would never have expected it, but too many things are in place."
"No chance it's a frame?" Ebenezer blinked and shot me a look.
"Why do you ask?"
"Because if the ass is finally getting his comeuppance, I want to make sure it's on the level," I said. He nodded a couple of times. Then he said,
"I don't see how it could have been done. It looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck. Odds are it's a damn duck. Occam's razor, Hoss."
"Someone could have gotten into his head," I said.
"At his age?" Ebenezer asked.
"Ain't likely." I frowned.
"What do you mean?"
"As a mind grows older, it gets established," he said. "More set in its ways, like a willow tree. Supple when it's young, but gets more brittle as it ages. Once you've been around a century or so, it generally ain't possible to bend a mind without breaking it."
"Generally?"
"You can't push it that far," Ebenezer said.
"Push a loyal man into betraying everything he believes in? You'd drive him insane before you forced him into that. Which means that Morgan made a choice."
"If he did it," I shook my head. "I just keep asking myself, who profits most if we axe Morgan ourselves?" Ebenezer grimaced.
"It's ugly all the way around," he said. "But there it is. I reckon you gazed him, Hoss. But it ain't a lie detector. You know that too."
I fell silent for a while and sipped coffee. Then I asked,
"Just curious, who holds the sword when you catch him?
It's usually Morgan who does the head chopping."
"Captain Lucio, I reckon," Ebenezer said. "Or someone she appoints. But she ain't the kind to foist something like that off on a subordinate."
I got treated to the mental image of Anastasia decapitating her old apprentice. Then of me taking Molly's head, I shuddered.
"That sucks."
Ebenezer kept staring at the fire, and his eyes seemed to sink into his head, as if he'd aged 20 years right in front of me.
"Aye."
The door to the war room opened, and a slender, reedy little wizard in a tan tweed suit entered, lugging a large portfolio. His short white hair was curled tightly against his head, and his fingers were stained with ink. There was a pencil tucked behind one ear, and a fountain pen behind the other. He stopped and peered around the room for a moment, spotted Ebenezer, and bustled right on over.
"Pardon, Wizard McCoy," he said. "If you have a moment, I need you to sign off on a few papers." Ebenezer put his coffee on the floor and accepted a manila folder from the little guy, along with the fountain pen.
What this time, Peabody?
First power of attorney for the office in Jakarta to purchase the building for the new safe house, Wizard Peabody said, opening the folder and turning a page. Ebenezer scanned it, then signed it. Peabody turned more pages. Very good. Then an approval on the revision of wages for wardens. Initial there, please. Thank you. And the last one is approval for ensuring Wizard Lafortier's holdings are transferred to his heirs.
Only three? Ebenezer asked.
The others are eyes only, sir.
Ebenezer sighed. I'll drop by my office when I'm free to sign them.
Sooner is better, sir, Peabody said. He blinked and seemed to notice me for the first time. Ah, Warden Dresden, what brings you here?
I thought I'd come see if someone wanted help taking Morgan down, I drawled.
Peabody gulped. I see.
Has Injun Joe found anything? Ebenezer asked.
Peabody's voice became laced with diffident disapproval as he answered. Wizard listens to wind is deep in preparations for investigative divination, sir.
So no, I said.
Peabody sniffed. Not yet. Between him and the Merlin, I'm sure they'll turn up precisely how Warden Morgan managed to bypass Senior Counsel's security. He glanced at me and said, in a perfectly polite tone, they are both wizards of considerable experience and skill, after all.
I glowered at Peabody, but I couldn't think of a good dig before he had accepted the papers and pen back from Ebenezer. Peabody nodded to him and said,
thank you, sir.
Ebenezer nodded absently as he picked up his coffee cup, and Peabody bustled out again.
Paper-pushing twit, I muttered under my breath.
Invaluable paper-pushing twit, Ebenezer corrected me. What he does isn't dramatic, but his organizational skills have been a critical asset since the outbreak of the war. I snorted. Bureaucromancer. Ebenezer smiled faintly as he finished his cup, the first couple of fingertips of his right hand stained with blue ink. Then he rose and stretched, drawing several faint popping sounds from his joints.
Can't fight a war without clerks, hoss.
I stared down at my half cup of coffee.
Sir, I said quietly, speaking hypothetically, what if Morgan is innocent?
He frowned down at me for a long moment. I thought you wanted a piece of him. I've got this weird tick where I don't want to watch wrongly accused men beheaded.
Well, naturally you do, but Hoss, you've got to understand.
Ebenezer froze abruptly and his eyes widened. They went distant with thought for a moment, and I could all but hear gears turning in his head. His eyes snapped back to mine, and he drew in a slow breath, speaking in a murmur.
So that's it. You sure?
I nodded my head once.
Hell's bells, the old man sighed. You'd best start asking your questions a lot more careful than that, Hoss.
He lowered his chin and looked at me over the rims of his spectacles.
Two heads fall as fast as one, you understand?
I nodded slowly.
Yeah. I don't know what I can do for you, he said. I got my foot nailed to the floor here until Morgan's located.
Assuming it's not a duck, I said, where do I start looking?
He pursed his lips for a moment, then he nodded slowly and said, Injun Joe.
Chapter 15. The senior council members, as it turned out, do not live like paupers. After I passed through still more security checkpoints, the stone hallway yielded to a hall the size of a ballroom that looked like something out of Versailles. A white marble floor with swirls of gold in it was matched in color to elegant white marble columns. A waterfall fell from the far wall into a pool around which grew a plethora of plants, from grass to roses to small trees, forming a surprisingly complex little garden. The faint sound of wind chimes drifted through the air, and the golden light that poured down from crystals in the ceiling was indistinguishable from sunlight. Birds sang in the garden, and I saw the quick, darting black shape of a nightingale slalom between the pillars and settle in one of the trees. A number of expensive, comfortable-looking sets of furniture were spaced in and near the garden,
like the sets you sometimes see at the pricier hotels. A small table against one wall was covered with an eclectic buffet of foods, everything from cold cuts to what looked like the sautéed tentacles of an octopus, and a wet bar stood next to it, ready to protect the senior council members from the looming threat of dehydration. A balcony ran around the entire chamber, 10 feet up, and doors opened onto the senior council members' private chambers. I paced through the enormous, grandiose space of the ostentatiatory to a set of stairs that swept grandly up one wall. I looked around until I spotted which door had a pair of temple dog statues standing guard along with a sleepy-looking young man in a warden's cape and a walking cast. I walked around the balcony and waved a hand at him. I was just about to speak when both temple dog constructs abruptly moved, turning their heads toward me with the grating sound of stone sliding against stone. I stopped in my tracks and held my hands up a little. "Nice doggy." The young warden peered at me and said something in a language I didn't recognize. He looked like someone from Eastern Asia, though I couldn't have guessed at his nation of origin. He stared at me for a second, and I recognized him abruptly as one of the young men on Ancient Mai's personal staff. The last time I'd seen him, he'd been frozen half to death, trying to bear a message to Queen Mab. Now a broken ankle had presumably kept him from joining the search for Morgan. Some people are just born lucky, I guess. "Good evening," I said to him, in Latin, the official tongue of the White Council. "How are you?" Lucky stared at me for another moment before he said, "We are in Scotland. It is morning, sir." Right. My half-hour walk had taken me 6 time zones ahead. I need to speak with Wizard Listens to Wind. "He is occupied," Lucky told me. "He is not to be disturbed." "Wizard McCoy sent me to speak to him," I countered. "He felt it was important." Lucky narrowed his eyes until they were almost closed. Then he said, "Wait here, please. Do not move." The temple dogs continued staring at me. Okay, I knew they weren't really staring. They were just rock. But for essentially mindless constructs, they had an intense gaze. "That will not be a problem," I told him. He nodded and vanished through the door. I waited for 10 uncomfortable minutes before he returned, touched each dog lightly on the head, and nodded to me. "Go in." I took a wary step, watching the constructs, but they didn't react. I nodded and went on by them, trying not to look like a nervous cat as I passed from the ostentatiatory into Lafortier's chambers. The first room I came to was a study, or an office, or possibly a curio shop. There was a massive desk carved out of some kind of unstained wood. Though use and age had darkened the front edge, the handles of the drawers, and the area immediately in front of the modern office chair. A blotter lay precisely centered on the desk with a set of 4 matching pens laid in a neat row. Shelves groaned with books, drums, masks, pelts, old weaponry, and dozens of other tokens that looked as though they came from exotic lands. The wall spaces between the shelves were occupied by shields fronted with 2 crossed weapons, a Norman kite shield with crossed broadswords, a Zulu buffalo hide shield with crossed assegais, a Persian round shield with a long spike in its center with crossed scimitars, and many others. I knew museums that would declare Mardi Gras in the galleries if they could get their hands on a collection half that rich and varied. A door at the far end of the study led into what was evidently a bedroom. I could see a dresser and the foot of a covered bed, approximately the size of a railroad car. I could also see red-black droplets of blood on the walls. "Come on, Harry Dresden," called a quiet, weathered voice from the bedroom. "We are at a stopping point and waiting on you." I walked into the bedroom and found myself standing in a crime scene. The stench hit me first. Lafortier had been dead for days, and the second I crossed the threshold into the room, the odor of decay and death flooded my nose and mouth. He lay on the floor near the bed. Blood was sprinkled everywhere. His throat gaped wide open, and he was covered in a black-brown crust of dried blood. There were defensive wounds on his hands, miniature versions of the slash on his throat. There might have been stab wounds on his torso under the mess, but I couldn't be sure.
I closed my eyes for a second, swallowed down my urge to throw up, and looked around the rest of the room. A perfect circle of gold paint had been inscribed on the floor around the body, with white candles burning at 5 equidistant points. Incense burned at 5 more points halfway between the candles, and take it from me, the scent of sandalwood doesn't complement that of a rotting corpse. It just makes it more unpleasant. I stood staring down at Lafortier. He had been a bald man, a little over average height, and cadaverously skinny. He didn't look skinny now. The corpse had begun to bloat. The front of his shirt was stretched tight against its buttons. His back was arched and his hands had locked into claws. His teeth were bared in a grimace.
"He died hard," said the weathered voice,
and Injun Joe Listens to Wind stepped out of a doorway that led to a bathroom, drying his hands on a towel. His long hair was gray-white, with a few threads of black in it. His leathery skin was the ruddy bronze of a Native American complexion, exposed to plenty of sunshine, and his eyes were dark and glittering beneath white brows. He wore faded blue jeans, moccasin boots, and an old Aerosmith t-shirt. A fringed leather bag hung from a belt that ran slantwise across his body, and a smaller, similar bag hung from a thong around his neck.
"Hello, Harry Dresden."
I bowed my head to him respectfully. Injun Joe was generally regarded as the most skilled healer on the White Council, and maybe in the world. He had earned doctoral degrees in medicine from 20 universities over the years, and he went back to school every decade or two to help him stay current with modern practice.
"Went down fighting," I agreed, nodding to Lafortier.
Injun Joe studied the body for a moment, his eyes sad. Then he said,
"I'd rather go in my sleep, I think."
He glanced back at me.
"What about you?"
"I want to be stepped on by an elephant while having sex with identical triplet cheerleaders," I said. He gave me a grin that briefly stripped a century or two of care and worry from his face.
"I've known a lot of kids who wanted to live forever."
The smile faded as he looked back to the dead man.
"Maybe someday that will happen, but maybe not. Dying is part of being alive."
There wasn't much I could say to that. I was quiet for a minute.
"What are you setting up here?"
"His death left a mark," the old wizard replied.
"We're going to reassemble the psychic residue into an image."
I arched an eyebrow.
"Is that even possible?"
"Normally, no," Injun Joe said. "But this room is surrounded on all sides by wards. We know what they're all supposed to look like. That means we can extrapolate where the energy came from by what impact it had on the wards. It's also why we haven't moved the body."
I thought about it for a minute. What Injun Joe was describing was possible, I decided, but only barely. It would be something like trying to assemble an image illuminated by a single flash of light by backtracking how the light in the flash had all bounced around the room. The amount of focus, concentration, and the sheer mental process that would be involved in imagining the spell that could reassemble that image were staggering.
"I thought this was open and shut already," I said.
"The evidence is conclusive," Injun Joe said.
"Then why are you bothering with this thing?"
Injun Joe looked at me steadily and didn't say anything.
"The Merlin," I said.
"He doesn't think Morgan did it."
"Whether he did it or not," Injun Joe said, "Morgan was the Merlin's right hand. If he is tried and found guilty, the Merlin's influence, credibility, and power will wane."
I shook my head.
"Gotta love politics." "Don't be a child," Injun Joe said quietly. "The current balance of power was largely established by the Merlin. If he is undone as the leader of the council, it will cause chaos and instability across the supernatural world."
I thought about that for a minute. Then I asked, "You think he's going to try to fake something?" Injun Joe didn't react for a moment. Then he shook his head slowly and firmly.
"I won't let him."
"Why not?"
"Because Lafortier's death has changed everything."
"Why?" Injun Joe nodded toward the study. La Fortier was the member of the council with the most contacts outside of the Western nations, he said. Many, many members of the council come from Asia, Africa, South America, most of them from small, less powerful nations. They feel that the White Council ignores their needs, their opinions. La Fortier was their ally, the only member of the senior council who they felt treated them fairly. I folded my arms, and the Merlin's right-hand man killed him. Whether Morgan is guilty or not, they think he did it. Possibly on the Merlin's orders, Injun Joe said. If he is found innocent and set free, matters could turn ugly, very ugly. My stomach turned again. Civil war, Injun Joe sighed and nodded. Fantastic. Where do you stand? I asked him. I would like to say that I stood with the truth, he said, but I cannot. The council could survive the loss of Morgan without falling to pieces, even if it means a period of chaos while things settle out. He shook his head. A civil war would certainly destroy us. So Morgan did it, and that's all there is to it, I said quietly. If the White Council falls, who will stand between humanity and those who prey upon it? He shook his head, and his long braid gently bumped his back. I respect Morgan, but I cannot permit that to happen. He is one man balanced against mankind. So it's gonna be Morgan when you're finished, I said, no matter who it really is. Injun Joe bowed his head. I doubt that it will work, even with the Merlin's expertise. What if it does? What if it shows you another killer? You start picking who lives and who dies, and to hell with the truth? Injun Joe turned his dark eyes to me, and his voice became quiet and harder than stone once. I watched the tribe I was expected to guide and protect be destroyed, Harry Dresden. I did so because my principles held that it was wrong for the council or its members to involve itself in manipulating the politics of mortals. I watched and restrained myself until it was too late for me to make a difference. When I did that, I chose who would live and who would die. My people died for my principles. He shook his head. I will not make that mistake again. I looked away from him and remained silent. If you would excuse me, he said, and walked from the room. Hell's bells. I had been hoping to enlist Injun Joe's aid, but I hadn't counted on the additional political factors. I didn't think he'd try to stop me if he knew what I was up to, but he certainly wasn't going to help. The more I dug, the messier this thing kept getting. If Morgan was vindicated, doom. If he wasn't vindicated, doom. Doom, doom, and doom. Damn. I couldn't even be angry at Injun Joe. I understood his position. Hell, if it was me on the senior council, and I was the one making the call, I wasn't completely confident that I wouldn't react the same way. My headache started coming on again. How the hell was I supposed to do the right thing if there wasn't a right thing? Chapter 16. I stared at Lafortier's corpse for a moment longer, shook my head, and then pulled one of those disposable cameras you can get from a vending machine out of my duster pocket. I walked around the room snapping pictures of the body, the blood splatters, and the broken bits of furniture. I ran through the entire roll of film, making the most complete record of the scene that I could, and then pocketed the camera again and turned to leave Lafortier's chambers. Back in the ostentatiatory, I heard voices drifting up from below. I nodded pleasantly to Lucky, who gave me an inscrutable look, and walked to the balcony railing. Listens to Wind and the Merlin were standing by the buffet table, speaking quietly. Peabody hovered in the background, carrying a different set of folders, ledgers, and pens. I paused for a moment to listen. It's a trick I picked up somewhere along the line. Not really magic, per se, as much as it is turning my mental focus completely to my sense of hearing. To find out the truth,
the Merlin was saying as he loaded up a plate with tiny sandwiches and wedges of cheese and fresh green grapes. Surely you have no objection to that.
I think the truth is already well established,
Listens to Wind replied quietly.
We're just wasting time here. We should be focusing on controlling the fallout.
The Merlin was a tall man, regal of bearing, with a long white beard and long white hair to go with it, every inch the wizard's wizard. He wore a blue robe and a silver circlet about his brow, and his staff was an elegant length of pure white wood, completely free of any marking. He paused in loading his plate and regarded Injun Joe with a level gaze.
I'll take it under advisement.
Injun Joe listens to Wind, sighed, and held up his hands, palms forward, in a conciliatory gesture.
We are ready to begin.
Let me get some food in me, and I'll be right in.
Ahem, Peabody said diffidently. Actually, Wizard listens to Wind. If you could sign a few papers for me while the Merlin eats, it would be greatly appreciated. There are two files on your desk that need your approval, and I have three...
He paused and began to juggle the load in his arms until he could peer into a folder.
No, four others here with me.
Injun Joe sighed.
Okay, he said. Come on.
The two of them walked toward the stairs leading up to the balcony, turned the opposite way I had when they reached the top, and entered a chamber on the far side of the room. I waited until they were gone to descend the staircase to the ground level. The Merlin had seated himself in the nearest group of chairs and was eating his sandwiches. He froze for a second as he saw me, and then smoothly resumed his meal. Funny. I didn't like the Merlin much more than I would a case of flaming gonorrhea, but I had never seen him in this context before. I'd always seen him at the head of a convened council, and as this remote and unapproachable figure of unyielding authority and power. I never even considered the notion that he might eat sandwiches. I was about to go on past him, but instead swerved and came to a stop, standing over him. He continued eating, apparently unconcerned, until he finished the sandwich.
Come to gloat, have you, Dresden? He asked.
No, I said quietly. I'm here to help you. He dropped the bit of cheese he'd been about to bite into. It fell to the floor unnoticed as his eyes narrowed, regarding me suspiciously.
Excuse me.
I bared my teeth in a cold little smile. I know, it's like having a cheese grater shoved against my gums just saying it. He stared at me for a silent minute before taking in a slow breath, settling back into the chair and regarding me with steady blue eyes.
Why should I believe you would do any such thing?
Because your balls are in a vice and I'm the only one who can pull them out, I said. He arched an elegant silver eyebrow.
Okay, I said. That came out a little more homoerotic than I intended.
Indeed, said the Merlin.
But Morgan can't stay hidden forever and you know it. They'll find him. His trial will last about 2 seconds. Then he falls down and breaks his crown and your political career comes tumbling after. The Merlin seemed to consider that for a moment. And he shrugged a shoulder.
I think it's far more likely that you will work very, very hard to make sure he dies.
I'd like to think I work smarter, not harder, I said. If I want him dead, all I need to do is stand around and applaud. It isn't as though I can make his case any worse.
Oh, said the Merlin, I'm not so certain.
You have vast talents in that particular venue.
He's already being hunted. Half the council is howling for his blood.
From what I hear, all the evidence is against him, and anything I find out about him is going to be tainted against him by our antagonistic past. I shrugged.
At this point, I can't do any more damage, so what have you got to lose?
A small smile touched the corners of his mouth.
Let's assume, for a moment, that I agree. What do you want from me?
A copy of his file, I said. Everything you found out about Lafortier's death, and how Morgan pulled it off, all of it.
And what do you intend to do with it? The Merlin asked.
I thought I'd use the information to find out who killed Lafortier, I said.
Just like that.
I paused to think for a minute. Yeah, pretty much. The Merlin took another bite of cheese and chewed it deliberately.
If my own investigations yield fruit, he said, I won't need your help. The hell you won't, I said. Everyone knows your interests are going to lie in protecting Morgan. Anything you turn up to clear him is going to be viewed with suspicion. Whereas your antagonism with Morgan is well known, the Merlin mused. Anything you find in his favor will be viewed as the next best thing to divine testimony. He tilted his head and stared at me. Why would you do such a thing? Maybe I don't think he did it. His eyebrows lifted in amusement that never quite became a smile, and the fact that the man who died was one of those whose hand was set against you when you were yourself held in suspicion has nothing to do with it. Right, I said, rolling my eyes. There you go. There's my self-centered, petty, vengeful motivation for wanting to help Morgan out, because it serves that dead bastard LaFortier right. The Merlin considered me for another long moment and then shook his head. There's a condition. A condition, I said, before you will agree to let me help you get your ass out of the fire. He gave me a bleak smile. My ass is reasonably comfortable where it is. This is hardly my first crisis, Warden. And yet you haven't told me to buzz off. He lifted a finger, a gesture reminiscent of a fencer's salute. Touché. I acknowledge that it is, technically, possible for you to prove useful. Gosh, I'm glad I decided to be gracious and offer my aid. In fact, I'm feeling so gracious, I'm even willing to listen to your condition. He shook his head slowly. It simply isn't sufficient to prove that Morgan is innocent. The traitor within our ranks is real. He must be found. Someone must be held accountable for what happened to LaFortier. And not just for the sake of the Council's membership. Our enemies must know that there are consequences to such actions. I nodded. So, not only prove Morgan innocent, but find the guy who did it, too. Maybe I can set the whole thing to music and do a little dance while I'm at it. I feel obligated to point out that you approached me, Dresden. He gave me his brittle smile again. The situation must be dealt with cleanly and decisively if we are to avoid chaos. He spread his hands. If you can't present that sort of resolution to the problem, then this conversation never happened. His eyes hardened. And I will expect your discretion. You'd hang your own man out to dry, even though you know he's innocent. His eyes glittered with a sudden cold fire, and I had to work not to flinch. I will do whatever is necessary. Bear that in mind as you help me. A door opened upstairs, and in a few seconds Peabody began a precarious descent of the stairs, balancing his ledgers and folders as he did. Samuel, the Merlin said, his eyes never leaving me, be so good as to provide Warden Dresden with a complete copy of the file on LaFortier's murder. Peabody stopped before the Merlin, blinking.
Yes, of course, sir, right away.
He glanced at me. If you would come this way, Warden. Dresden, the Merlin said in a pleasant tone, if this is some sort of ruse, you would be well advised to be sure I never learn of it. My patience with you wears thin. The Merlin was generally considered to be the most capable wizard on the planet. The simple words with their implied threat were almost chilling. Almost. I'm sure you'll last long enough for me to help you out of this mess, Merlin. I smiled at him and held up my hand, palm up, fingers spread, as if holding an orange in them. Balls, I said. Vice. Come on, Peabody. Peabody blinked at me as I swept past him on the way to the door, his mouth opening and closing silently several times. Then he made a few vague, sputtering sounds and hurried to catch up with me. I glanced back at the Merlin as I reached the door. I could clearly see his cold, flat, blue eyes burning with fury while he sat in apparent relaxation and calm. The fingers of his right hand twitched in a violent little spasm that did not seem to touch the rest of his body. For an instant, I had to wonder just how desperate he had to be to accept my help. I had to wonder how smart it was to goad him like that. And I had to wonder
if that apparent calm and restrained exterior was simply a masterful control of his emotions, or if, under the pressure, it had become some kind of quiet, deadly madness. Damn Morgan for showing up at my door, and damn me for being fool enough to open it. Chapter 17. Peabody went into an immaculate office lined with shelves bearing books arranged with flawless precision, grouped by height and color. Many of the shelves were loaded with binders, presumably full of files and documents, similarly organized in a dazzling array of hues. I guess it takes all kinds of colors to make a bureaucratic rainbow. I started to follow him inside, but he turned on me with a ferocious glare.
"My office is a bastion of order, Warden Dresden. You have no place in it."
I looked down at him for a second. If I was a sensitive guy, that would hurt my feelings. He gave me a severe look over his spectacles and said, as if he thought the words were deadly venom and might kill me,
"You are an untidy person."
I put my hand over my heart, grinning at him.
"Ow!"
The tips of his ears turned red. He turned around stiffly and walked into the office. He opened a drawer and started jerking binders out of it with more force than was strictly necessary. "I read your book, by the way," I said. He looked up at me and then back down. He slapped a binder open. "The one about the Earl King," I said, "the collected poems and essays." He took a folder out of the binder, his back stiff. "The warden from Bremen said that you got the German wrong on the title," I continued. "That must have been kind of embarrassing, huh? I mean, it's been published for like 100 years or something. Must eat at you."
"German," said Peabody severely, "is also untidy."
He walked over to me with the folder, a pad of paper, an inkwell, and a quill.
"Sign here."
I reached out for the quill with my right hand and seized the folder with my left. "Sorry, no autographs." Peabody nearly dropped the inkwell and scowled at me.
"Now see here, Warden Dresden."
Now, Simon," I said, taking vengeance on behalf of the German-speaking peoples of the world. "We wouldn't want to screw up anyone's plausible deniability, would we?"
"My given name is Samuel," he said stiffly. "You, Warden Dresden, may address me as Wizard Peabody."
I opened the file and skimmed over it. It was modeled after modern police reports, including testimony, photographs, and on-site reports from investigating wardens. The militant arm of the White Council, at least, seemed to be less behind the times than the rest of us dinosaurs. That was largely Anastasia's doing. "Is this the whole file, Sam?" He gritted his teeth.
"It is."
I slapped it shut. "Thanks."
"That file is official property of the Senior Council," Peabody protested, waving the paper and the ink. "I must insist that you sign for it at once."
"Stop!" I called. "Stop, thief!" I put a hand to my ear, listening solemnly for a few seconds, and shook my head. "Never a warden around when you need one, is there, Sam?" Then I walked off and left the little wizard sputtering behind me. I get vicious under pressure. The trip back was quieter than the one in. No B-movie escapees tried to frighten me to death, though there were a few unidentifiable bits wrapped in spider silk hanging from the trees where I'd established the pecking order, apparently all that was left of the bug I'd smashed. I came out of the Never Never and back into the alley behind the old meatpacking plant without encountering anything worse than spooky ambience. Back in Chicago, it was the darkest hour of night, between 3 and 4 in the morning. My head was killing me. And between the psychic trauma the skinwalker had given me, the power I'd had to expend during the previous day, and a pair of winter wonderland hikes, I was bone weary. I walked another 5 blocks to the nearest hotel with a taxi stand, flagged down a cab, and returned to my apartment. When I first got into the business, I didn't think anything of sacrificing my sleeping time to the urgency of my cases. I wasn't a kid in my 20s anymore, though. I'd learned to pace myself. I wouldn't help anyone if I ran myself ragged and made a critical error because I was too tired to think straight. Mister, my bob-tailed gray tomcat, came flying out of the darkened apartment as I opened the door.
He slammed his shoulder into my legs, startled me half to death, and nearly put me on my ass. He's the next best thing to 30 pounds of cat, and when he hits me with his shoulder block of greeting, I